Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about all sorts of things related to food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you on a community radio station, which is a fine place to be. Thank you for joining us at our kitchen table today. Here, update on a few things. I gathered my first few cherry tomatoes. So, yes, it is summer here in Iowa. And here is an update on a calf. 2 weeks ago on the Donalana Kitchen, we were interviewing Kevin Dietzel, who is a dairy farmer. And he was out in his field doing his Zoom connection from there on his phone. And believe it or not, right behind him, because we could see behind him, a little calf was born, so we kind of did a play-by-play. And Kevin says the calf and the mother is called Orsla, and she's doing fine. And it was a little boy calf, which does not have a big future in the dairy industry. So it has gone off to be with other little boy calves to the Gilbert farm. So that's an update on the little calf that was born. So, fires, floods, drought, all of these unsettling topics in the news are on our minds today. Heat, lack of rainfall are threatening large areas of the West and Midwest. And on the other end of it, people are getting tornadoes and floods and all sorts of things. And since we talk about food and how this affects our plates, what are those places that are having challenging weather are places where we get a lot of our food? Joining us at our table today is Maggie Norton.
Yes, Maggie Norton is the Practical Farmers of Iowa Farm Outreach Coordinator. And she's here to, I have to put this little bit in. When I was growing up, my mother always used to say, dinner table conversation should never be about sex, politics, or religion, nothing contentious, which left the weather. You could always, in polite society, talk about the weather. But now the weather has become anxiety-producing. So Maggie is here to help us talk about an anxiety-producing phenomena, which we are all experiencing, and it's called weather. Maggie, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen, and tell us about your background and why you know so much about weather
and climate.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for being here. So drought particularly fascinates me as a conversation in Iowa. My background, I finished my master's degree at Iowa State in Rural Sociology and Sustainable Ag in 2019. And the project that I was on, it was a grant that went across state lines. It was both in Iowa and Minnesota. And what we wanted to do was investigate the intersection of agriculture, water resources, and climate change. And our counterparts in Minnesota were like, oh, well, irrigation is obviously a water resource that we need to look at. And with climate change, we're seeing an impact on groundwater levels. Let's look at this. So on our end in Iowa, we tried to find something analogous to that. And we stumbled and couldn't find anything. But finally, we landed on a case study in Northwest Iowa, looking at groundwater levels and livestock production during the 2012 drought. And so what we wanted to understand was, how do these things all relate to one another? How did people get through the 2012 drought? And how are people viewing potential for drought moving forward? And that 2012 drought for a lot of people that were in Iowa at the time was really, it was pretty devastating. And in Northwest Iowa in particular, there's over 40% of livestock is produced in that corner of the state. And so when the water resources started dwindling, there was a real concern for livestock well-being. and whether there'd be water resources for them. So I learned through this process that water quantity is a real concern in Iowa. But usually when we talk about water in Iowa, we're talking about water quality first. And then it might be, if we're talking about quantity, it's usually too much water. It's too much water from flooding events. It's too much water on the landscape. And so there's, you know, miles and miles and miles and millions of dollars invested in tile drainage to get water off the landscape and away. And so when we think about drought, it's this just insidious phenomena that creeps along and like finds its way into our lives and people's livelihoods without us really seeing or sensing it. And it doesn't have the same infrastructure impact that something like a flood would. So I'm excited to talk all about drought and what I, you know, I have a personal interest in the drought now because of my master's research.
Oh, very good. You recently, well, you said back in May, there was a webinar that you were part of and other people were kind of talking about this clear back in May. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So back in May, some federal and state stakeholders got together to do a webinar drought update. And they included the state climatologist, the director of the Midwest Climate Hub, deputy director of operations for the USGS, hydrologist at Iowa Geologic Survey, and then somebody from IDNR. And they were each giving updates on critical systems. So a climate update and trends, stream level flow, groundwater levels, irrigation patterns and trends. And my big takeaway from that meeting, Justin Glisson, the state climatologist, said that without enduring storms over months, not weeks, things aren't going to change. And so that was back in May.
And that's just for Iowa. That's us.
Just for Iowa. Yep. And so when, you know, when I think about the brief storms that we have had recently, you know, I refer back to that meeting and think, well, you know, it's great that we got some inches, but inches I don't think is going to cut it for us, unfortunately, in the grand scheme of things.
And were they doing at this, on this webinar, were they doing predictive, they were predicting a very dry summer? Is that what the deal was, basically?
Yeah, Dennis Toddy, he's the director of the Midwest Climate Hub, and he said that drought conditions in Iowa aren't really changing. They're kind of at a steady state. And steady state is good because it doesn't mean that it's getting worse, but it also doesn't mean that it's getting better. And so they were predicting based on precipitation modeling that, you know, included precipitation and temperature, looked at stream flow and groundwater, that moving forward, conditions weren't going to improve, that we'd probably have a persistent drought throughout the rest of this year in Iowa.
When we think of drought in Iowa, we don't think about this often, but then the term aquifer comes into everybody about, oh, there's water underneath our feet. Oh, no problem. Well, you mentioned that not all aquifers are created equal, or the water in there is, you have to think about it differently. Talk about aquifers, will you please, Maggie?
Yes, I can talk specifically about the difference in aquifer types in Northwest Iowa. And I know that this does transcend boundaries into other parts of the state, but maybe like Northeast Iowa could be completely different than Northwest. But in Northwest Iowa, you should think about groundwater as either being a shallow source, a shallow alluvial aquifer that is sometimes called like sweet water. It's really good quality. It's hydrologically active, so it requires frequent precipitation to recharge. And then deep groundwater, these deeper aquifers are larger in the quantity of water that's available, but it's not always the best quality water. So you run into a lot of issues with that those deeper aquifers having like a high mineral content. If you think of water that you've had that has like an irony type of taste to it, it's because it's coming from a deeper aquifer. And so you run into some quality issues once you do get into those deeper sources.
So is the message that our Iowa aquifers are somewhat depleting, rapidly depleting, or are they stable? I mean, we're not on the Ogallala aquifer, thank heavens.
I don't think so, are we?
No, we're not. Even in the West, right? It still doesn't really reach, well, because that's the one that's notoriously been drawn down beyond replenishment levels for, you know, much of, well, west of us, you know, where they're growing things that require irrigation every year. So, but this is not true for Iowa. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's not the same situation as the Ogallala. We're not, and this is out of my area of expertise, but just based on my conversations with people in respect or reference to Northwest Iowa, depletion of those deep water aquifers isn't necessarily a concern. But what is interesting is that rural water systems are a really common water source for folks in rural areas of the state, and then in particular Northwest Iowa. And they actually have started pumping water from out of state into Iowa. The Lewis and Clark pipeline is a pipeline that's actually pumping water north along the Iowa and Minnesota border, and then it jumps down into Northwest Iowa, and I can't remember which county, but there is an instance where we're bringing water in from out of state to help supply consumer demand.
Yes, that has been a change in the past 10, 20 years. People don't have, people in rural areas used to have their own wells, and that's got its pluses and minuses, but people now have gone to the rural water districts, and oh my goodness, we're pumping it from elsewhere, eh?
Now, is that because of the quality concerns about Iowa water? Why are we importing water into the state of Iowa?
A little bit of that. So I learned a little bit of history about that, and I think it was sometime in the 80s, there was a really bad drought, and wells weren't sufficient. So they decided to put in these rural water systems for a more, consistent supply, reliable supply of water for rural homesteads. And throughout the 80s and 90s, they installed all these rural water systems for domestic use for homes on the landscape. But that has changed a lot too, right? So it's not just homes that are hooking up to these rural water systems now. It's also livestock feeding operations, which is a much higher demand than what you or I would use throughout the day.
So this is mostly confinement operations for pigs. Is that what you're referring to largely?
Yeah. I mean, any animal feeding up, it's not a guarantee that somebody that has an animal feeding operation, whether that's pigs or cattle or turkeys or chickens, it's not a guarantee that they're hooked up to a rural water system. But a rural water system, if they can hook up to it, is more reliable than, let's say, their shallow well, that they might not have access to good deep aquifer water. So they might just have a shallow well that is more susceptible to drought during these like hot durations.
So you're saying that by building these watering systems up in the 80s, it's enabled increased demand, basically, because if the water's there, then farmers build more animal operations.
Yeah, it's a resource that's available. I mean, there's a lot of other contributing factors to why there'd be an increase in animal feeding operations, but it's definitely a more readily available resource now than what it might have been in the past. Mm-hmm. But then once you get to a drought situation, in 2012, that's when it got tricky because all of these these properties that had animal feeding operations linked up to the rural water system, they might have had it only as a backup. So they weren't using it consistently. They just had it there in case they needed it. So as the 2012 drought carried on and the water levels in their own shallow ground, their groundwater wells started declining, all these producers flipped the switch on the rural water system so that they could plug into that secondary source. But what they weren't prepared for on the rural water system end or the municipal end was that demand of all those switches turning on and having.
Yeah, because everybody needed it at the same time, right?
Yeah, yep. Huh. And they were facing their own supply issues because some rural water systems have deep aquifers, some have shallow and deep, and they mix them. And so it's this really complex system of sources and infrastructure to get the water to where it needs to be. And they've learned a lot since 2012. But now that we're approaching a situation this year that looks really similar, like stream water in that webinar update, they shared some stream water flows from this year and last year. And the stream water flows are tracking really similarly to what it looked like in 2012. And so if that's an indicator of what's to come, it's, you know.
So
pause.
We're thinking that this year looks about as bad as 2012 was?
Based on my interpretation of the information that was shared, it gave my stomach a rolling sensation of what could be to come.
Okay.
Well, you know, by comparison, we're still sitting pretty here in Iowa. I mean, you know, what started the conversation about having a program about drought and water resources are, of course, the terrible conditions that have happened over the last two or three weeks on the West Coast, all the way up into Canada with, you know, unbelievably high temperatures and, you know, over 200 deaths from heat stroke and things like that. And I saw an article yesterday that all of the mollusk populations going up, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, all the way up into Canada. So they got hit with those above 100 degrees, right, on a low tide day and killed thousands, millions of oysters and mussels and, you know, all that inner shore beach life, which some of which is, you know, it's farmed for food. When we eat mussels or oysters, they come from all our coastal areas, and it's devastating for oyster farmers, for example. Not only that, people don't think about this, but when all those little shore creatures die, it's very stinky. So the beaches are going to be a disaster. I mean, there was just no way to like turn the water on in the ocean and cool off that kind of farming. It's really, we forget about all of these things.
Oh, and keeping in mind too, the West Coast, California, well, yeah, and all the way farther north. A lot of food is grown there. It's going to be interesting to see what sort of impact that has on food production. Already people are turning off their irrigation out there and just plain fallowing a few things. You found some articles about
that. Yeah, well, we forget that the California Central Valley produces lots of food that is directly, you know, for going to the grocery stores and getting onto our plates. Huge quantities of our vegetables in this country come from, you know, either the West Coast or some places to the South, which is a whole nother issue. But in California, you know, I lived there for many, many years, and I was always like, you know, I'm a Midwestern farming girl. I can see that sooner or later, growing that much food in a desert climate, they're gonna have to turn the tap off. So it is happening. Large water in California, most of the water typically comes off the mountains in the north, and it runs in these huge canals that you can see when you're driving along the highways. The water is running south to down to Los Angeles. And if you all remember the movie Chinatown, it was all about the water wars in the early part of almost 100 years ago, right? Well, the solutions at the time are not going to be resilient enough for what we're going through right now. Lots of farmers are fallowing their fields, and particularly rice farmers, because it's very water intensive. Almonds, which are also very intensive. But fallowing a rice field, you can do for 1 year, and because farmers have water rights. So their water rights, that you can sell your water rights if you're not using it. So a lot of rice farmers have decided in California to sell their water rights this year rather than trying to grow rice. Okay. But the almond farmers, which also use a lot of water, that is not a crop that you plant in 1 year and it yields. You know, you've got to grow the trees up. But a lot of almond farmers are going to have to let go and are letting go of their, they just can't grow those crops. So that will eventually affect the Midwest because it will change the food markets a lot. Of course, we've talked a lot about this on the radio show, that we are trying to promote not just corn and soy here in Iowa, but a local food market so we can at least feed ourselves. And, you know, it used to be, oh, golly, I don't know, certainly in my grandparents' day, Iowa, for example, had areas of the states that grew a lot of squash, and we had squash canneries, or still the melons. What's the town on the Mississippi River where they still Muscatine melons? You know, we used to grow a lot more produce in Iowa, and I suspect that, you know, California's loss might be our opportunity. Maggie, what do you think? What's PFI is working hard to diversify crops here in Iowa.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely folks on our team that are working hard to help provide more opportunities for farmers that want to grow something besides corn and soybeans. And there's a lot of barriers to get to that point. Land access is really difficult. Getting access to capital, just the insurance and the economic structure, the policy structure for anybody that wants to grow something besides corn and soybeans is just really fraught with hurdles. And so we're trying to provide some resources and opportunities for people to expand their operations or like start operations that are, you know, fruit and veggies or orchards or silvopasture pasture or, you know, anything that's diversifying the landscape.
Well, there was in the New York Times article about the drought in California, there was one rice grower who said, yeah, you know, I'm going to fallow a large percentage of my land this year, but she's not going to fallow all of it because you put not just your farm out of that business, but she said it will also affect the rice millers, the rice distributors, the people that are hired to spray the crops, all of these auxiliary things. And here in Iowa, one of the things that we need to rebuild is even distribution of lots of different things. If you're growing corn or soy, you're all set. Your local, you know where to take it, you know how to sell it, the transportation is all there, the market is all set up. But if you want to grow even a small grains crop, you have to find a way to get the crop out of the field to the market, the buyer. You know, I mean, we do have, we're building up, don't you think, some more infrastructure for small grains in Iowa, which is a good thing, but it's a lot of work. It's not just, oh, well, the farmer plants it and it's fine. It takes other levels of businesses to also start up.
Yeah. You have to have somebody that's going to, you know, take that product,
buy it,
yeah, right. Have a market for it to, you know, make sense to put all those resources towards the small grain crop. So we've got cost share programs that help with that. So farmers can sign up for a cost share program where PFI with supply chain partners help provide funding towards seeds or like, you know, to put the small grain crop in, and then they have a market to send it to once they're ready to harvest as well. I think another really good example of what you're talking about, Donna, is meat processing, right? Mm-hmm. So the pandemic showed us that when we get to, when we build systems that are really specialized and integrated in a really complex way.
Large scale.
Yeah. That when you have a disruption like the pandemic, what happens when one of these processors goes offline? So over the decades, the smaller producer, or not the producers, but the meat lockers and medium-sized small meat processing facilities across the state diminished in their presence. And these large processors just grew across the state. And hopefully now we're starting to, build back those smaller processing facilities. So
we're learning. Yes, we are learning. We're talking to Maggie Norton from Practical Farmers of Iowa about drought and some challenges that we all have to learn to live with here. I want to take this time to mention that this is KHOI Community Radio, and this is Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was two tunes. We started out with a tune called The Tempest. I tried to get something in here that had a little bit of natural disaster to it. So we had an Irish tune called The Tempest. We're talking about drought and
weather.
We depend so much on things that are beyond our control, and we ask so much of the rain. We ask so much of the water in our rivers and streams and lakes and our aquifers. One thing that we do, and because we're human beings, we have lawns. I have a little bit of information here about. We may want to consider our relationship to lawns during a drought, because here's some information from a study done by NASA, and actually it's repeated by others, but here's a few facts and figures. There are 400 million acres of lawns in the United States of America, and that's about three times as many acres as there are acres of corn. Just kind of wrap that around your mind a little bit. And those lawns, if you want to keep them nice and green, can use up to 9 billion gallons of water a day. Good news there, okay? And this is even more interesting. Lawn mowing can take 4% of the U.S. CO2 emissions. Our good old lawnmowers, who are not really very energy efficient. They just putt back and forth there.
Well, so I guess the message is have a smaller lawn if you have to have one, and get one of those old push mowers.
That's good. Yeah. Anyway.
Actually, they're not old. I did get one a few years ago. There are some very nice, sharp German models that are not as difficult to use as the old-fashioned ones, but they are completely hand, human-powered, basically.
Yeah. Or you can get a goat, that too. Okay, good. Well, we're here with Maggie Norton, and we're talking about drought and things that we do to deal with challenges. You mentioned PFI, the farmers, Practical Farmers of Iowa, they talk to one another. How have they been doing during the drought?
I think it varies across the state, but people are definitely watching the weather very closely. And they're starting to talk about, I don't know if anyone caught the heat dome. They've been talking about this heat dome sitting over Canada and the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, and so there was some chatter on the email discussion list for PFI members, too, where some farmers had inquired with others, you know, as we look at this heat dome and think about the potential for really hot days or a span of really hot days in Iowa, what are we going to do about our livestock? And so there's some good discussion back and forth about, you know, what options there might be, what different farmers we're going to try to do. So our members are one resource for our farmers in the state who are getting ready to move into any precarious climate situation, just to have some more farmers to ask questions of and get some feedback on strategies.
Mm-hmm. I often look up a website put together by a permaculture organization. It's called permies.com. And they talk about everything under the sun, of course. And just yesterday, there was a chat bit by some farmers and small landholder permaculture people in the Northwest. And they mentioned that a lot of small farmers and people that raise small flocks of chickens and goats, there have been chickens that have just completely given up in this heat dome. They don't mean just stop laying eggs. They've had quite a few dead animals out there, and they're normally we're talking the Northwest where cool, shady sort of thing. And it's pretty dire. They put together a list of how to just make your small garden more resilient. And if you have a backyard garden or even a market garden, here are some tips here. They suggest planting perennials, which is a good idea. If we can get those orchards going, we might be going. And plant in a lot of different microclimates. Even on a hot day, being in the shade makes a difference, and that makes a difference for your plants, too. And plant from seeds when you can. Huh? Our growing season may be too short for some of those things, but plants grown from seed, they kind of, they're resilient. Create your own land races, which means save seeds from hardy plants. And plant lots of different kinds of plants, because if something doesn't work, something else generally does. And think about feeding yourselves through the winter. Plant low-maintenance, high-calorie stuff, as in put yourself in a few rows of potatoes. With a little bit of mulching, that can do pretty well. So thinking about how we can feed ourselves when California and places west may be kind of iffy, or at least prices may be kind of iffy.
Well, I did read that the U.S. wheat crop is predicted to be 40% smaller than last year. That's pretty significant. Now, mostly that's west of us. I mean, we do grow some wheat here in Iowa, and we have our local miller in Panora at Early Morning Harvest, and Earl does grow some of his own wheat. But that should make wheat a little expensive come fall. The other bit of research, this is out from out of the North Carolina State University. This is about soybeans. Now, this is should be big news in Iowa. They reported that warmer temperatures and increased ozone, which are two aspects of climate change, harms the soybean roots and the microorganisms in the soil, reducing the carbon stored in the soil. So, you know, it's not just drought. We've got a lot of things going on here. We had a show, I think, last year where we touched on this topic that this is very, very new research, but it is something that's really concerning, that the higher the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, that sort of supercharges growth in all green leafy things, which is all the grains, which is all of the forages. And it looks like it's bigger and you think, oh, that's good. But the problem is with that supercharged growth from the carbon, it's actually reduced in nutrient density. So you may be getting more grass, but the grass will not be as nutritious if you're feeding your cows, for example. So we've got some serious things, unknowns. You know, we think space flight is complicated. We're having enough trouble here on Earth. I don't know. No.
So we see drought happening west of here and around us too. But Maggie, you said there's other parts of the country that have just the opposite happening.
So I'm from Pennsylvania originally, and my family all lives out in Pennsylvania. And yesterday, my dad started sending me a bunch of pictures of water coming streaming across the road and down through their field where there's not supposed to be streams of water. And so they received, I'm not sure how many inches of rain, but severe flash floods throughout the county and power outages and everything that comes along with it. So, yeah, the same time that we're talking about drought, there's other parts of the country that are being affected by completely different weather events on the other end of the spectrum.
Well, I did read, you know, that the heat that's been in Southern California, which is, for example, Death Valley reached a new high of 130 degrees. Well, it's going to get a little bit cool. It started cooling off yesterday. It was only 125 degrees. But what's coming on the heels of this cooling and on the southern west coast is they are now predicting flash floods in Arizona and New Mexico in the next few days.
Ha!
So, you know, like, you know how we all felt when we got at least I did when we got our first really major thunderstorm of the summer. It was like, oh, hallelujah, hear that lightning crack and the drama of it and the beauty of the rain falling in more than just a few piddling drops. And we did have some hail some places in Iowa, didn't we?
Yeah. So when we got some in Ames, at least, it was just a steady storm from what I was around for. But on Friday, I was driving on Route 30 heading through Greene County. And we had been north of there just prior, and we got in the car for a little while to ride out a thunderstorm that was just a steady rain, no big deal. But on the ride home, along 30, there were fields that were just tattered. Just the corn stalks were, you know, tattered and broken. And then there was one field we passed, and I didn't quite understand what I was looking at first because I've never seen it before, but it was this entire field with stems sticking up. And I realized afterwards it was a soybean field that had been completely defoliated by the hail and the wind that had come through. So there's been some intense storms within the state too just recently.
Well, we're very dependent on the weather, aren't we? What is it we always say? If you stick around and you talk about the weather, it's always going to, at least it's going to change.
Yeah, I think it also, and one thing that you mentioned before, Donna, you said, oh boy, we have rain finally. But as Maggie said, 1 inch here and there is not going to do it because water has to be stored underneath. And I bet all of the plants and the roots that we're in the soil right now, just absolutely sucked up everything that fell. I don't think anything really ran off. Although I did actually see a little water in the creek. I don't know
the river, you know, the Skunk River does not look any higher at all. Okay. And I'm a regular out at Peterson's Pits because I swim, and it did cool off. The water temperature is cooler, but it certainly didn't, the puddle did not get any bigger.
Are practical farmers planning on they can kind of guess what the yields are going to be already, or is there a discussion of that sort of thing?
Oh gosh, Lana, those are conversations that I at this point am not privy to enough to give an estimation on.
Too early to tell. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. For more information on community radio and on this fine radio program, go to www.khoyfm.org. Back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're concerned about severe weather and where we're going to get our food, because as Maggie said, when a field is completely stripped by hail or doesn't grow because of no water, well, that's a little less food for us. There are options here. PFI actually has got some farmers that are growing in more confined situations, like vegetables in hoop houses and greenhouses and all that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. We've got farmers that have orchards throughout the state. We've got farmers that are growing fruits and vegetables in hoop houses, or they're starting them maybe in a hoop house or a greenhouse and then planting them out in a field afterwards. But there's a diversity of fruits and vegetables that are produced within the state, aside from corn and soybeans.
So the main impetus behind a hoop house is to extend the season so you can start earlier and grow longer. Also, I remember Bruce at the farmer's market. He grew all his tomatoes in hoop houses because he said on his farm, the wind was so strong that he did better growing all the tomatoes in the hoop houses.
Yeah, we're learning new things. Here's a little news item, and you can comment on this too, Maggie. There is a new venture here in Ames, a news item I got out of the Ames paper. There's a new business called Nebulum. It is a startup subscription service for free, fresh, delivered, fresh
not
grown.
Free.
Not free. free delivery of fresh grown produce to residents' doorsteps. And this lettuce that they're selling is grown hydroponically inside, never to see the light of day, so to speak.
Or to touch the soil.
Yeah, this is a whole thing where they spray nutrient-rich mist
roots. Are they designing this system so they can send it into outer space when we have to colonize a whole new planet because we've sort of ruined the one we live on?
Yes.
Oh dear.
Well, I don't know. This they're two young men here from in Ames here, Clayton Mooney and fellow founder Danon Poole, tried this new venture, and they've got money backing them and everything.
Lots of money, several million dollars. Yeah, right?
It's an engineering feat of growing things very efficiently inside and growing growing greens. They're trying to expand into
Right now they're growing lettuce and microgreens.
And microgreens, but they're trying other stuff too. They are serving 150 households in Ames and Des Moines area, but they plan for more. I don't know. What do you guys think about stuff inside?
I mean, first of all, you have to understand that this is this kind of venture, and there are several others, like we covered the shrimp farmers. These are people that have been through the ISU kind of innovation ag training program, and they're having these kind of startup ideas. And Ames seems to be the testing ground for some of these. I mean, you have to realize that the kind of investment that this Nebulan company has made is not just to grow lettuce for Ames. It's basically to build a system which they can then sell to other urban areas. So the Nebula money will not be in lettuce. It will be in actually selling the systems to other entrepreneurs who want to make their money selling lettuce. And Ames is sort of the test dummy site for, you know, how to market it. And I'm sure they need numbers of how profitable it is, or et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, basically what they're doing is it is a hydroponic system. Some of it is what's called vertical growing. So instead of flat things where plants are sitting in water, they've actually reduced the water and energy costs, which is a good thing if you're going to be into this sort of thing. I believe they're misting the plants with high levels of nutrients, no pesticides, because of course it's indoors, so they don't have pests, which is a good thing. Frankly, I wasn't, you know, I'm an old curmudgeon. I like my lettuce that's been grown in the sun. So I'm not a candidate for their business venture, but this is the future, a possible future of foods. I'm certainly hoping it's not the future of foods.
Well, it seems to fit in with, oh, we must save water. We must save water. Ah, but it seems there's a lot of other energy costs here, growing things with the heat and light and air conditioning and all that sort of thing. And,
to keep nature out of the farm, it must be very, very complicated situation.
Interesting.
So I did get a flyer on my front gate offering to sell me lettuce a few months ago. And obviously what they said, they had 150 buyers in Ames. Mm-hmm. So some people must be trying it out. They compared it to the old milk delivery system. You get your salad greens right at your front door. How much did it cost? Where was that thing? So the Ames Trib had a whole thing on it where it said, how much it costs. Was that maybe at the end of the article? I don't know. Oh yes. How it works. Every Wednesday morning, the Ames region, and Thursday morning for Des Moines, 52 weeks a year, they harvest and package produce for same-day delivery. Customers sign up at eatlettuce.com to receive 1 pound of red butterhead lettuce, around 8 servings. I don't know what they're calling a serving, but it's at $13 for the red butterhead lettuce, and 2 containers of microgreens for $11, and 2 servings of tomatoes for $5, either weekly or biweekly. Now, Lana, you're the tomato grower. What is a serving of tomatoes? Is that a whole tomato? Is that a half a big beefsteak? I mean, I don't know. It's a little anyway, imprecise.
Well, good for them if they can get that all growing inside. Yep, but again, yep, it's not just the water. There's a lot of energy happening here.
Yeah, yes, so imagine what an engineered solution, right? This is an engineering solution to...
That's exactly right, the ag engineers.
You know, there's such a complex natural system that already exists and already works so well, and to get those plants in the soil and let the soil do the job it's intended to do is, yeah,
Well, you know, I'm sorry to be such a curmudgeon, but it sounds like a Richard Branson, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, shoot the moon sort of endeavor. You know, we're going to go to another planet because we're getting uncomfortable here. Doesn't sound like a solution to me.
Well, at least we're going to find out. There's people out there that are asking the questions. And
I guess so. And there's some very expensive questions to be asking.
Yes. Do you have anything else you want to add about water, about drought, about challenges, and how Iowa farmers and PFI farmers are meeting challenges?
I just think, you know, the water conversation in Iowa is so much broader than just water quality. Water quality is obviously a huge concern in our state and has repercussions for communities that are downstream, but there are quantity concerns. And I think it's just the more opportunities that folks have to listen to programs like this or engage with the water summary reports that IDOLS does to have a handle on what's going on in the state just makes us all more informed and able to make better decisions as we move forward. And then, great. Of course, you know, PFI has a really great network of farmers and non-farmers that share resources and insights. And so I encourage anyone, even if you're not a farmer, to go to practicalfarmers.org and check us out and participate in some of those community building networking opportunities.
Well, yes, thank you. There are people that are talking about this, and Practical Farmers of Iowa is one place to go. Thank you for joining us today, Maggie, with Maggie Norton from Practical Farmers of Iowa.
Yes, and we have to remind you all that we all need water to drink and we all need food to eat. So this is not just for farmers.
Right.
We're all eaters and drinkers.
Yes, very good. Thank you, Maggie. Thank you. Also, I want to mention a few things here. You know, besides all of the weather and the climate that we can talk about, we've been through this COVID thing all last year.
Another force of nature.
Another force of nature. Yes. And so a lot of face-to-face events are just kind of coming back online, as they say right now. And small town festivals, small town celebrations are back. Ames had a 4th of July celebration last weekend in Story City. The Scandinavian Days came back with a flurry and they celebrated their carousel up there and they had kumla on a stick and everything. It was good. Crossroad Festival.
In Colo, yes.
Yeah, in Colo, in the Hickory Grove Park grand opening was last Saturday. That's good. And there are more coming up. It's kind of besides the Iowa State Fair.
Oh, yes.
That's coming up. Okay, here's a few things that will be coming up. So kind of realize that you can go and see people face to face and do things like
out of doors
and go to parades and softball tournaments and things. Zering Days, Zering, July 23rd, 24th, 25th. Gilbert Days, July 30th and July 31st. They have carnival games and laser tag there and a car show. Maxwell Old Settlers is August 6th, 7th, and 8th. Boone's Pufferbilly Days, August 6th through 8th. Nevada's Lincoln Highway Days will be August 28th, and the Huxley Prairie Festival will be held August 27th and 28th, and the theme will be the Roaring 20s. So we can do that.
That reminds me, are we doing RAGBRAI this year?
Yeah, there is RAGBRAI.
Oh, my.
Speaking of out in the heat.
Annual events, yeah.
I think it's happening. Well,
we'll have to check that out for you.
I'm not going. I don't bicycle very well. I prefer to sit in a lawn chair with a cool drink. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you for being at our kitchen table today. And join us next week when we do some more Donna Lana Kitchen stuff. You've been listening to The Donalana Kitchen, we come to you Tuesdays at noon and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. or anytime at www.khoifm.org. Today we had music by Four Shillings Short. More Irish music to go out with here. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.